Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for a journey through the explosive, tragic, and absolutely essential life of a man who didn't just tell jokes. He detonated cultural assumptions.
He really did.
We are talking about Leonard Alfred Schneider, better known to the world, of course, as Lenny Bruce.
You know, calling Lenny Bruce an architect of modern comedy, it's true, but it almost feels like it's not enough. He was, first and foremost, a satirist, a relentless social critic. Stand-up just happened to be his medium.
Right.
And when you look at his work, especially from, say, the late 50s and early 60s, it is this volatile cocktail. He's blending deeply uncomfortable discussions of politics, religion, race, sex, and what was then considered, just terminal vulgarity.
And it wasn't just edgy for the sake of being edgy. It felt revolutionary.
Right.
And because he dared to push language past that point of polite society, it became incredibly dangerous for him, personally.
Oh, absolutely.
The core of this deep dive, really, is how he took stand-up comedy and just turned it into this constitutional battleground. I mean, his 1964 obscenity conviction and all the legal trials that followed, they were landmark moments, absolutely landmark moments for the idea of freedom of speech in the United States.
They were. He really shaped the First Amendment debates that, you know, we're still having today. He transcended the stage. He became this figure that the establishment desperately, desperately wanted to silence.
Yeah.
He forced the entire country, and especially the legal system, to look really critically at the definition of language, of morality, of social hypocrisy. And his influence, it's not just historical, it's in the DNA of modern comedy.
The fearless kind of comedy.
Exactly. You look at Rolling Stone magazine. In 2017, they ranked him the third best stand-up of all time.
Right behind Pryor and Carlin.
Right. And Comedy Central did the same thing back in 2004. So those high rankings tell you that the material he forged in those really turbulent years is still the bedrock for anyone today who decides to push past that acceptable line.
So our mission today is to trace that explosive path. We're going to use this source material to go from his, frankly, chaotic early life through his transformation into this dark angel of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to meticulously document the exact points of conflict.
The arrests, the bizarre arguments in court.
The blacklisting.
Yeah.
Everything that defined his tragically short career.
And, you know, we should probably start this deep dive with the ultimate validation. It's a detail that brings the entire story full circle and offers this moment of retroactive justice.
The pardon.
37 years after his death, in 2003, New York Governor George Pataki granted him a posthumous pardon for that central obscenity conviction. It was this formal state-level acknowledgement that they were wrong. They were wrong to try and censor his voice.
Okay, so let's unpack this from the very beginning. Leonard Alfred Schneider, born in Mineola, New York, 1925, to a Jewish family.
Right, and his father, Myron Schneider, was British-born, worked as a shoe clerk. Yep. But Lenny, he barely saw him. His parents divorced when he was young.
So the real influence was his mother.
Oh, enormous. A defining influence. Her name was Sally Marr, born Sadie Kitchenberg.
And she was in show business herself, right?
She was. Sally Marr was a stage performer, a dancer, operating mostly in that low-end, gritty world of burlesque. So Bruce was just immersed in that world from a very young age.
The raw side of it?
The raw side. The constant hustle, the lack of social constraint. That environment definitely contributed to the restless, almost chaotic energy that defined his entire life. He spent time living with various relatives, just hopping from place to place. And then his life took this, defining, if also chaotic, turn toward military service during World War II.
And that restless energy drove him right into the U.S. Navy. He was, incredibly young?
He was 16 in 1942.
Wow, and his service was active. He was on the USS Brooklyn, saw action across the Mediterranean, Northern Africa, Palermo in 43, the intense landings at Anzio in Italy in 44. But his exit from the military, it is one of the most quintessential Lenny Bruce stories. It just shows his inherent defiance, his flair for turning established systems on their head.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because this single act of subversion, it foreshadows everything about his later legal strategies. In May of 1945, Bruce performed a comedic routine for his shipmates dressed in drag.
Which was probably not standard morale-boosting entertainment.
No. It genuinely upset his commanding officers. They saw it as this unacceptable breach of military decorum. So in response, and this was a deliberate, calculated act of defiance to get a discharge, he concocted a plan.
He decided to weaponize the prejudices of the era against the institution itself.
Precisely. He successfully convinced the ship's medical officer that he was experiencing homosexual urges.
And at the time, that was a guaranteed ticket out.
It was. Given the strict moral codes, the automatic unsuitability, it was a sure thing. This was next-level psychological warfare against the establishment, and he was a 19-year-old kid. He basically used a societal taboo as a self-inflicted legal defense against rules he wanted to escape.
So he gets an undesirable discharge.
Yeah.
Which carried a huge stigma back then.
It did. But even then, he was tenacious. He fought that discharge, and he successfully applied to have it changed to under honorable conditions by reason of unsuitability for the naval service.
He understood bureaucracy. He knew how to work the system, even when it was working against him.
That tells you everything about his future career right there. He was determined to control his own narrative, and that restless energy just continued. Later, during the Korean War era, he served again, this time in the U.S. Merchant Marine, ferrying troops.
So after all that, he settles in New York City.
Yeah.
And he's just another hopeful trying to make it.
One of thousands. Initially, he was really struggling to stand out. He spent a lot of time at Hanson's Diner, which was this vital spot for up-and-coming performers. And it was there that he met Joe Ansis.
Okay, Joe Ansis, this name comes up a lot. Why was he so important? What was the specific influence?
The sources credit Ansis with instilling in Bruce this idea of moving comedy beyond the predictable setup punchline format. Ansis' style was described as involving stream of consciousness sexual fantasies and these direct, often obscure references to modernist jazz.
So like intellectual improvisation.
That's a great way to put it. Instead of telling a joke, you'd explore a topic, you'd follow the rhythm of language and thought, like a musician playing a solo.
So if the dominant comedy of the day was this neatly packaged joke, Ansis and then Bruce were trying to find the messy, spontaneous rhythm of real human thought.
Absolutely. That shift from structure to spontaneity is key. You can hear that spontaneous, musical, dense rhythm in Bruce's best work. It's what let him weave together political theory, obscenity, and grammar into a seamless performance.
And he started performing as Lenny Marcel, right? For his mother's show.
He did. He was the master of ceremonies at the Victory Club. And those early stream of consciousness ad-libs started getting big laughs. He officially changed his last name to Bruce around 1947.
His first actual stand-up gig in Brooklyn in 47 earned him $12 and a free spaghetti dinner.
A very humble start for a cultural earthquake.
He even did the Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts radio program, doing a routine called the Bavarian Mimic. So he started with impressions.
Yeah, inspired by Sid Caesar, impressions of Bogart, Cagney. But that Ansis influence quickly pushed him towards something much more dangerous, biting social commentary.
So moving into the mid-50s, he was. He was really prolific, not just on stage, but in low-budget film.
He was. His early creative output included screenplays for some really unusual projects. It shows a financial necessity, a willingness to work anywhere. He wrote Dance Hall Racket in 53.
Which featured him, his wife Honey Harlow, and his mother Sally Moore. A real family affair.
Then Dream Follies in 54, a low-budget burlesque romp. And maybe make surprisingly, The Rocket Man, a children's film, also in 1954.
That juxtaposition is incredible. A burlesque film starring his stripper wife and then a children's film. It perfectly encapsulates the contradictions in early Bruce. He was hustling.
He was. He collaborated a lot during this time. Frank Ray Parilli was a mentor and manager, and the photojournalist William Carl Thomas was crucial. They worked on screenplays together that never got filmed, but Thomas was integral to recording his first three comedy albums. He shot those iconic cover photos.
And here's a piece of trivia that every Saturday Night Live fan needs to know. He was roommates with Buddy Hackett in the 50s.
They were, and they appeared together on the Patrice Munsel show between 57 and 58, and their comedy duo name was the Not Ready for Prime Time Players.
That's incredible, nearly two decades before Lorne Michaels.
It's a direct, if accidental, line of comedic inheritance. But the real career turning point came when he crossed the line from, you know, suggestive humor to truly confrontational material. He was famously fired from the Slate Brothers nightclub for what Variety headlined as blue material.
And that incident provided the theme for his first solo album,
which was called The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce. And that label, Sick Comic, immediately stuck. It defined this new genre of boundary-pushing humor that challenged the sunny optimism of post-war America.
We should be clear here. What exactly did critics at the time mean by sick?
They meant that he was diagnosing and dissecting the ills of society, subjects that were completely off limits. He wasn't telling jokes about mothers-in-law. He was using satire, black humor, harsh language to critique organized religion, racial prejudice, the Vietnam War, the hypocrisy of American sexual morality.
His humor was intellectual. It was designed to provoke thought, not just get a laugh.
Exactly. If America was pretending everything was perfect, Bruce was the one shining a spotlight on the rot underneath. Mm-hmm. He wasn't doing safe joke punchline stuff. He was basically performing philosophy. And he refined it at Enrico Banducci's North Beach nightclub, The Hungry Eye.
Right after Mort Saul, another brilliant political satirist.
And that venue allowed him to develop the complexity that required patience from an audience. He shifted from just being blue to being genuinely dangerous because he was intelligent. And unfortunately, that growing reputation meant he was essentially blacklisted from television.
He only got on screen thanks to supporters like Hugh Hefner and Steve Allen.
Right. Hefner put him on Playboy's penthouse in 59. But even those appearances came with severe limitations. I mean, the sources say his jokes had to be typed out and pre-approved by network censors.
So they were trying to sanitize him.
They were. But Bruce was fundamentally unsanitizable. Even with those constraints, he couldn't stick to the script. On his debut on The Steve Allen Show, he made an unscripted comment about the huge scandal of Elizabeth Taylor marrying Eddie Fisher. He just asked, "Will Elizabeth Taylor become bar mitzvahed?"
A classic Bruce move. Injecting uncomfortable reality and religious context into a celebrity scandal. And that spontaneity, that refusal to comply, that's what drove him to the zenith of his live career, the famous Carnegie Hall performance.
Midnight, February 4th, 1961, during a severe blizzard that basically shut down New York City.
The commitment of that audience.
Yeah.
Walking through the snow. There were like 2,500 people there.
And Bruce performed for hours. It was legendary. It was recorded and released as the three-disc set, the Carnegie Hall Concert, and it captures his material at its absolute peak.
Albert Goldman, his biographer, captured the essence of that night perfectly. He said Bruce worshipped the gods of spontaneity, candor, and free association.
And that's the key. Goldman noted that Bruce's greatest fear was getting his act down pat, becoming rigid. On that night, fueled by that audience, he rose to every stimulus with what he called a mad volleying of mental images that suggested the fantastic riches of Charlie Parker's horn.
Comparing him to a modernist jazz musician.
It's the perfect comparison. He wasn't a comedian in the traditional sense. He was an improviser. He saw language like notes ready to be riffed on, broken down, reformed in real time. That's the difference between a joke writer and a true satirist of his caliber.
But while his artistic career was hitting this incredible peak, his personal life was just spinning out of control.
Completely. He met and married the stripper Honey Harlow in 1951, and he was deeply determined for her to stop stripping. But the irony is that their shared chaotic life, which was fueled heavily by drug use, often made that kind of stability impossible.
They worked as a double act, right?
They did, on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. But Honey still worked at the Colony Club, which was the top burlesque club in L.A. Their daughter, Kitty, was born in 1955. And Bruce's determination to, you know, legitimize his life and get Honey off the stage was this constant source of friction.
Because their shared addiction required constant money.
Which often forced Honey right back into the clubs. And what's truly fascinating and deeply tragic is that the setting for his big creative breakthrough was the very environment he was trying to escape.
The low-end strip clubs in the San Fernando Valley.
Exactly. He was the master of ceremonies in these lowest of the low venues. Goldman argued that it was precisely when Bruce sank to the bottom of the barrel working these rough places that he felt free to shed his restraints.
No censors.
No censors beyond the immediate audience, and they certainly weren't going to be shocked by language. This environment allowed him to blow with a spontaneous freedom that really did resemble his jazz musician friends. It was in that moral chaos that he developed his moral clarity.
But that same pressure cooker, fueled by what the sources call serious drug use, led to constant tumultuous domestic fights.
Their relationship was just defined by separation and reunion over and over again between 56 and 66.
And it got really dark, criminal even.
It did. The chaos hit a peak in 1956 during a nightclub tour in Honolulu. Honey was arrested for marijuana possession, and Bruce, instead of supporting her, left her. And he kidnapped their one-year-old daughter, Kitty, and fled the state.
Yeah, that's just devastating. And Honey later claimed that Bruce was the one who turned her into the police.
A brutal allegation. It just speaks to the depths of their mutual suspicion and instability. Regardless of who made the call, she was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. It was a tragic, devastating chapter for both of them.
They finalized their divorce in 59.
he did have other relationships. An affair with the jazz singer Annie Ross in the late 50s, and Lotus Weinstock was his girlfriend and fiance when he died. But that final decade was just relentlessly defined by severe drug addiction. He was using heroin, methamphetamine, Dilaudid, daily.
And that led not just to personal conflicts, but serious health problems. It was all setting the stage for his early death.
The narrative of Lenny Bruce is so often just compressed into the obscenity trials. But before we get to those big constitutional battles, we have to talk about his early legal trouble.
Which was driven by that same impulse, getting quick money to get honey out of stripping. We're talking about the Brother Matthias scam in 1951.
That's right. Motivated by this desperate need for cash, he orchestrated this elaborate scheme. He was arrested in Miami for impersonating a priest.
The audacity is incredible.
He was soliciting donations for a leper colony in British Guiana using a legally chartered but entirely invented organization called the Brother Matthias Foundation. He reportedly posed as a laundryman to steal real priests' clergy shirts and a collo to look the part.
But here's a classic Bruce twist. He was acquitted.
And this acquittal shows his early mastery of legal technicalities. He was acquitted because the foundation was legally chartered in New York. He'd done the paperwork. And the leper colony in Guiana actually existed.
Plus, the local clergy couldn't definitively say he wasn't a priest.
Exactly. They could prove he solicited funds, but not that he stole an identity, since the foundation itself was technically legit. Bruce later claimed he made about $8,000 in 3 weeks. He kept $5,500 and sent $2,500 to the colony.
So that pattern of defiance, it didn't start on stage. It was deeply ingrained. But the real legal turning point, the start of the harassment that would define the rest of his career, that came in 1961, the San Francisco arrests.
October 4th, 1961. He was arrested at the Jazz Workshop for obscenity. And this is the arrest where the material was truly immortalized as a constitutional defense. He'd used the word cocksucker on stage.
A word the moral establishment found completely unforgivable.
But Bruce, the secular moralist who studied the dictionary like it was the Bible, mounted this brilliant linguistic defense. He transformed the courtroom into a classroom.
What was the core of his argument?
He famously dissected the word right there for the jury. He argued that to is a preposition, come is a verb, and insisted that the sexual context of come had no inherent weight of obscenity. He suggested that obscenity only existed in the mind of the offended party.
Provocatively arguing that if someone got upset hearing the word, they probably can't come.
Turning the moral condemnation right back on the accuser's own sexual repression. It was a stunning argument. Grammar, philosophy, and insult all rolled into one. He was acquitted by the jury in that case, but the damage was done.
Law enforcement now had a target, a high-profile, brilliant target.
And they began monitoring his appearances constantly. The list of subsequent arrests is staggering. 1961, Philadelphia, drug possession. 2 years later, in L.A., he was arrested again for language. The arresting officer was Deputy Sherman Block, who would later become the county sheriff.
And what was the crime this time?
The Yiddish word schmuck.
Wait, schmuck, as in jerk or fool?
Well, it literally translates to penis, and it was deemed legally obscene. Those charges were later dismissed, but it just highlights how ridiculous and petty the legal pressure had become.
They were looking for any excuse.
Any excuse. He was arrested on stage in Chicago in 1962, and internationally, his reputation preceded him. In 63, he was barred from entering the UK by the Home Office, classified as an undesirable alien. The world was literally closing in on him.
And this all culminated in the big New York trial in 1964.
April 1964. Arrested twice after performing at the Cafe Ogogo in Greenwich Village. And the club owners, Howard and Ellie Solomon, they were arrested too for allowing the performance.
A clear strategy to punish the venues and dry up his work.
This was the crucial legal battle, a three-judge panel. The prosecution was led by Manhattan Assistant DA Richard Koo, who was determined to win. Bruce's defense attorneys were Ephraim London and Martin Garbus, legal heavyweights who understood this wasn't about comedy, it was about the First Amendment.
And the trial featured this incredible list of cultural icons who testified or offered support. Woody Allen, Bob Dylan,
Jules Pfeiffer, Allen Ginsberg, Norman Mailer, William Styron, James Baldwin,
Dorothy Kilgallen, Herbert Gans. It's a who's who of mid-century American intellectual life.
And their collective argument was that Bruce was a moralist, a prophet using shock to expose societal flaws. James Baldwin said Bruce was simply doing the work of a writer, using the words that exist in the world to reflect the world.
But despite all that incredible support, he was found guilty.
Guilty of obscenity. November 4th, 1964. He was sentenced to 4 months in a workhouse, a harsh sentence for a speech crime. He was released on bail pending appeal.
And tragically, the legal process outlived him. He died before that appeal could be decided.
It's a critical detail, though, that the club owner's conviction, Howard Solomon's, was later overturned based on appellate rulings that favored free speech. So the legal tide eventually turned and vindicated the principles Bruce died fighting for, just too late to save the man himself.
The constant legal babbles didn't just drain his finances, they completely consumed his art. The sources say his routines in the last years of his life were just dominated by his legal troubles.
The satire devolved into rants about his court battles, tirades against fascism, bitter, self-pitying complaints about being denied his freedom of speech.
The irony is just, it's so thick. The man who fought censorship through brilliant art ended up censoring himself by replacing his art with his defense.
He was reading court transcripts on stage. The material became less observational and more of a desperate legal briefing. By 1966, he'd been blacklisted by nearly every U.S. nightclub. The system he mocked had successfully squeezed him out.
His ill-fated Australian tour in 1962 is a clear early example of this.
Oh, the media storm that followed him everywhere. He was booked for 2 weeks in Sydney, but his second show just caused this major public controversy.
What was the specific incident? What was the catalyst?
Pure, unadulterated provocation. A local actress, Barbara Wyndon, heckled him. She asked him to stop talking about America and talk about something different. Bruce, exhausted and annoyed, responded with the line that ended the tour. Fuck you, madam. That's different, isn't it?
And that one line was enough.
It was enough to ignite the Australian press. Sydney papers immediately denounced him as sick. One even used a retouched photo that made it look like he was giving a fascist salute. The venue canceled his shows. A university appearance was rescinded. A TV interview canceled.
Wow.
His final Australian concert drew only 200 people in a 2,100-seat theater. Heavy police presence. The performance was subdued. It's fascinating, though, a recording of that show, long rumored to have been made by the police, was rediscovered in 2011.
Amidst all this deterioration, though, there was one brief moment of lucidity. The Berkeley concert in December 65.
It became his last live album, and it's described as being lucid, clear, and calm, one of his best performances. A final flash of the genius that was still there.
But the final months were marked by steep decline. His penultimate performance at Basin Street West focused almost entirely on his legal troubles. He wasn't performing comedy anymore. He was performing his trauma.
His very last performance was June 25th, 1966, at the Fillmore in San Francisco on a bill with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention.
And the promoter, Bill Graham, recalled Bruce as being whacked out on amphetamine and just emotionally disturbed.
The pathos of that night is stunning. Zappa, who was a huge fan, asked him to sign his draft card as a gesture of solidarity. But Bruce, consumed by paranoia, refused. He was suspicious, convinced it was another trap by the authorities. His ability to distinguish friend from foe had completely collapsed.
And somehow, in the middle of all this chaos, he wrote his autobiography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People.
Serialized in Playboy, thanks to Hugh Hefner's continued support, published posthumously, it's an incredibly vital text.
His life ended tragically shortly after. August 3rd, 1966. Found dead in the bathroom of his Hollywood Hills home. He was only 40.
The official cause was acute morphine poisoning caused by an overdose.
And the scene itself became part of his tragic legend. The official police photo. Him lying naked on the floor, a syringe and burned bottle cap nearby.
His friend, the record producer Phil Spector, actually bought the negatives of those photos. He said it was to keep them from the press, trying to preserve some shred of dignity.
His memorial was as unconventional as his life. Over 500 people attended. Spector led it and encouraged attendees to bring box lunches and noisemakers, a fittingly chaotic send-off.
And the eulogy, delivered by the Reverend William Glenesk, it just summarized the essence of the man. He described Bruce as, in a sense, an evangelist on a street corner, who shattered its facades and its hypocrisy. His epitaph reads simply, "Beloved Father, devoted Son, peace at last."
His influence on the comedians who came after him? It's just impossible to overstate. Syndicated columnist Sidney J. Harris called him the Gertrude Stein of comedians.
A fascinating analogy, suggesting that while his own work might have been a dead end, too cryptic, too challenging for popular taste, out of that intellectual compost grew this flourishing new school of comedy.
And the proof is in the giants who followed him. Richard Pryor said, "Hearing Bruce changed my life."
And George Carlin, who so often focused on language itself, called Bruce a brilliant comedian who influenced him morally as well as comedically. Carlin was even arrested alongside Bruce once for refusing identification during a raid.
But the most concrete legal validation came decades after his death, the posthumous pardon.
2003, New York Governor George Pataki granted him a full pardon for that 64 obscenity conviction. 37 years later, the first posthumous pardon in the history of New York State.
And it's a remarkable detail, given their history, that his ex-wife, Honey, helped lobby for that pardon, a final acknowledgement of his constitutional struggle.
His cultural footprint just extends so far beyond comedy clubs and courtrooms. He became an icon of the counterculture. He's famously pictured in the top row of the collage on the cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Right alongside other cultural heroes who challenged the establishment.
And his death was noted in music history, too. Simon and Garfunkel's 7 o'clock News Silent Night features a newscast mentioning his death. And Paul Simon wrote the line, "I learned the truth from Lenny Bruce, that all my wealth won't buy me health."
Bob Dylan memorialized him in his 1981 song, Lenny Bruce, concluding with the line, "Lenny Bruce was bad, he was the brother that you never had."
And R.E.M. immortalized him in the rapid-fire references of It's the End of the World as We Know It, mentioning the LB Quartet. His life has been translated across so many different media.
The 1974 film Lenny, directed by Bob Fosse, with Dustin Hoffman getting an Oscar nomination, based on the Broadway play.
And the 1998 documentary Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, narrated by Robert De Niro, was also nominated for an Oscar.
And in modern media, a fictionalized version of him, played by Emmy winner Luke Kirby, is a crucial character in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. He's her friend, her champion, and a cautionary tale.
His legacy isn't just about his jokes. It's about the central tension he embodied. The uncompromising social critic using vulgarity to discuss sensitive subjects and the brutal organized legal persecution he faced for it. He was a tragic figure, consumed by addiction and legal strife, who died believing he'd lost before his work could be vindicated.
The cost of his candor was devastating. The system he fought literally hunted him down until his career deteriorated and ended in an overdose.
So what does this all mean for us today? Considering Bruce's long battle against obscenity laws, his desire to expose hypocrisy, we have to ask, how far have the boundaries of acceptable public discourse truly moved since his time?
That's a great question.
He fought overt legal censorship. Are the comedians and social critics of today who seek to speak uncomfortable truths facing fewer or just different forms of censorship? Maybe subtle social media deplatforming, economic cancellations, social shaming. Are these just the new versions of the legal battles that ultimately crushed Lenny Bruce? The debate over whose language is acceptable and whose truth is worth hearing remains profoundly relevant.
Food for thought indeed. That wraps up our deep dive into the trials and tragic legacy of Lenny Bruce. Thank you for diving in with us.